these youth, they're our neighbors. You know, they're playing with your kids on the playground. They're in our in your kids' schools, and they might be your kid. And you know, we're on a mission to help these young people fulfill their potential, of which there is a significant amount of untapped potential. And so, you know, we would love to hear from anyone who cares about this topic. We'd love to help you to have you, you know, join our movement in some way and help not just these young people, but help strengthen the community that we all live in.
That was my conversation with Andrew Grover and Ethan Belisco with Youth Villages Oregon. And for now, that's it. You've been listening to Free Culture Radio. We'll be back in a month to continue our examination of drugs, drug cultures, and the influence of drugs on society. Thanks again for listening. This is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long!
Listening to KBOO's All Thrills, No Frills Volume 4 Special Programming Campaign. Check out all the great special programs we're bringing you now through April 15th at kboo.fm/ATNF4.
Tune in every weekday morning from 5:30 to 7 a.m. for variations on the theme of folk music during KBOO's Folk Strip. Each morning brings you a different DJ and a wonderful variety of acoustic and roots music, both traditional and contemporary. You'll hear the latest from singer-songwriters, happy jigs and reels, bluesy folk, a sea shanty or two, some old favorites, local artists and artists from around the world, a touch of Cajun, a dose of indie, and a smidge of jug band. It's probably the best way on earth to wake up. So let us start your day with a smile. Again, that's every weekday morning from 5:30 to 7 a.m. for KBOO's folk music programs.
1, 2, 3, 4. Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
Never been done before.
We're talking about a subject.
To bring you to the light.
Farewell to you, people.
Davey D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. A couple of weeks ago, we got word that the school, formerly known as Mills College, I think they changed their name, but it will forever be known as Mills to me.
That's right.
Decided to make a bold move. You know, under new ownership, they, I think, got a police force to patrol their facilities over there off MacArthur. And I don't know how it went down, but our guests will be able to share with us. But they came up with the idea of saying, hey, our police force can patrol some of East Oakland, which is near Seminary and all that whole area. I don't think residents in that area knew about it. But here we are. Anti-Police Terror Project with Cat Brooks in them, they put out a press release alerting us, as well as people in the community that were pretty concerned about those dynamics. For example, who would the police department be reporting to? The city of Oakland or Mills College? And so we wanted to bring Cat Brooks on this afternoon to share with us what is happening with this and whether or not it's a good idea. There were some people said this would be great because Oakland needs all the help that it can get. And why not do this? And I'll say one thing before I let you come on, Kat. I've seen this type of scenario before. And what concerns me about it is that it's the privatization of a police force. And I'm going to give an example where this happened. Right here in the Bay Area, several years ago, Apple, along with some other tech companies, had a police force. It was a task force. I can't remember the name. But what I do know is that somebody took a computer, and this task force, this police task force, went from Silicon Valley all the way up to Emeryville and found the guy and arrested him. And I think people were, for the first time, was aware that there was a private police force that Apple had. And that police force had all the powers of police. They could stop you, frisk you, arrest you, and all that. The question was raised then, who are they responsible to, Apple, or are they responsible to the city and counties that they patrol, if they're even doing that? The other time before that, where we saw a police force at work, was with the RIAA, the music industry that was going around looking for bootleggers. Now, to this day, we're not sure if they were actual police, because they had the word police on their jacket, but they had RIAA, Recording Industry of America, I believe it's the full name. And again, this privatization of police, if you're rich, you know, you can afford it. And where does that lead people who decide that they want to direct their police to do things that are unethical, problematic, or outright racist in some cases? So, Kat, sorry to be long-winded, but those things came to mind when I first heard about this, and you know this area better than me, so thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Davey. So the first thing that I want to say is Mills College, which, yes, will forever in Oakland be known as Mills, is now Northeastern University. And it is it's a college that's based in Boston, actually. Mm. And so they've come in where the, you know, Mills campus used to be. And Clay Birch, who is a former Oakland Police Department officer, and anybody who paid attention to any statements that APTP or myself made about Wood Street, the Wood Street eviction, will know that Clay Birch was the Oakland police officer that oversaw that very violent encampment eviction, trying to prevent us and other people to provide help from getting inside, playing games with the city administrator so people could get services or resources. So this is Clay Birch. Clay Birch now works for Northeastern. And so some folks, there's two people, and I meant to have it pulled up. There's a woman that used to live in East Oakland who now lives in Las Vegas. And there's another guy who lives somewhere else in the state. But so neither of the drivers of this process actually live in the East Oakland that they want to have patrolled. So they got together with Clay and worked with the university to put together a proposal for a private police force that would not, as you pointed out, not only just patrol Northeastern, but all of East Oakland. When they met,
it's all of East Oakland.
All of East Oakland. But wait, David, I haven't gotten the punchline yet. When they mapped out all of East Oakland, they took it down to Trestle, Glen, and Grand.
What?
Yeah. Yeah. That's how well these
By Lake Merritt.
Listen.
By Lake Merritt.
Yes.
By the Grand Lake Theater.
That was their that was their map. All
wow.
the way.
I'm sure everybody here at the lake wants to know we in the East now. We East.
You know. Y'all got street cred now.
There's the deep East. There's the deep East and there's the shallow East. We're the shallow East.
So some key points about this. Because of the way our city charter right now, they can't do it. They have legal problems to be able to get it. So it went to city council, the admin, et cetera. They looked and they were like, nah, you can't do it. But the city attorney, as I understand it, is working with them to try to figure out how we get through this legal loophole. They will not, people also know, that the Oakland Police Department has been under federal oversight for 25 years now. I lose count as the years continue. That was supposed to be a five-year process. So there's an accountability metric, and then Oakland is also accountable, even though the budget is being slashed as the city tries to hamstring them, to a police commission, right, and independent investigators. This police department will not be. This police department will only be accountable to Northeastern. So if they beat you, they rape you, they, you know, kill you, they're not held accountable. Howsomever, we'll pay for it. They're not accountable to us,
but our city tax dollars
will be liable, and not Northeastern. So, in addition to the very big problem of putting more, I mean, you said, how much help does Oakland need? Okay, let's think about that. We got the OPD, we got the CHP, we got the sheriffs, we got East Bay Parks and Rec, we got, who else is rolling through? We got BART police, several more. How many cops is it going to take? If that is the answer, if the answer to making Oakland safe is more cops, how many millions and how many more? I want a number, because at this point, we're talking about at least seven different law enforcement agencies that are rolling through the flats of Oakland, messing with people. Right now, OPD, because of the work that all of us as a community did, they don't murder the way they used to. But make no mistake that they are still raping, pillaging, maiming, robbing, assaulting, racially profiling, and terrorizing our people. We're going to add one more to the mix that has absolutely no accountability. How bad can this get? Oh, and they can hire, like, security guards. They can hire officers that we don't know whose record is what from other places. They can hire whoever they want and endow them with the power to hurt our folks.
Cad Brooks, I want to ask you, you mentioned all the law entities that are in Oakland under the guise that we need help. I often asked, and you know, we've been trying to get records from OPD with those freedom of request things and have not been able to get them, to see how things are being used, how efficient they are. You know, is it really lack of personnel? Or last night, I should have taken a picture, but my kids were there to see, and we counted 1, 2, 3, 9 cop cars right up there on MacArthur for like two people. And we're not talking about guns drawn or anything, like just milling around. And I'm like, wow, 9, you know, like, it was OPD, it was sheriff, and some other things, right? 9 cars. And they've been there for a minute. And so, you know, to me, it's like, how much manpower do you need for, you know, two people that you seem to have contained? You know, meanwhile, you know, the headline that we had a couple of nights ago is that gas stations got robbed and the police couldn't do anything, et cetera, et cetera. Well, maybe there was a cluster of them that night, 11 deep. That's not the first time we've seen that. That's not the first time we've talked about it. It's not the first time we reported about it with pictures. Like, how many people do you need, you know, to handle situations? We remember when they had the drummers over at the lake, because last night was a red moon. That's why we're out, red moon. Yeah. And if you remember, Samba Funk had 14 cop cars to contain them because one person complained about drumming and kept them detained for 4 hours. So this is a thing where you look at that and you go, well, you know, a world-renowned band that everybody knows who worked with the city, you got 14 cop cars out there. Why? You know, what is the purpose? What's going on? You know, they were just playing drums and one person complained. So to me, it's just like efficiency, but from the work that you all have done, what have you seen to be the big hang up in terms of them not being able to do the job that people expect them to do?
Because people expect them to do the wrong job. Policing is not actually about protecting people, it's about protecting property, right? I mean, I think at this point, especially the folks that listen to your show, we all know the first cops were slave catchers and union crushers. That's what they, you know, that's what they were for, is to protect profit and property for people that were making profit off of our black bodies at that time that were considered Property. The other thing is, so it's twofold, right? So when you see them employing that tactic, depending on the time of day, if it's that shift change, right? Cops work 12-hour shifts, work, air quotes. They're on the clock for 12 hours. We pay them to work for 12 hours. At shift change, one of the ways, and I learned this while I was running for mayor from a former city administrator, because, you know, overtime is a huge, massive problem for OPD. Well, actually for us, because we pay for it. But at shift change, that's a shift change overtime trick.
Yeah.
Because as soon as they go, I think it's 5 minutes. As soon as they're over that 5 minutes, they're making time and a half. And so they will, you will see that. Pay attention at like, well, they work 6 to 12, 12 to whatever. Pay attention to what time it is when you're seeing a bunch of that happening, because they are literally just racking up your dollars for standing on the street.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, we've got cops in Oakland make $600,000 a year with overtime, $350,000 a year with overtime, $400,000 a year with overtime, and they're not working that kind of overtime.
And that's in the contract that allows them to do that?
Yeah, that's what the association... Oh, yeah. That's what they fight for. That's what OPOA fights for and wins. And then the city has the audacity when it comes to budget time to tell us we can't have clean parks. We can't have streets that are not going to jack up our tires. We can't have, more living wage job training programs. We can't have more beds for folks that are in mental health crisis or trying to recover from substance utilization. But we can have more police officers who jack up the system and steal our money. And if this is working, Davey, and this is my question, then how come we're on the top 10 most dangerous cities every single year and have been as long as I've been here? I'm confused. I'm confused about this narrative. And at some point, the folks got to wake up and really listen to what you're being told and then look at what's happening in these streets. And the other reason why they do that is terror. It is. They get off on that. They enjoy that. They enjoy, right, rolling 10, 12, 14 deep up on people and letting you know who's boss. That's the twistedness of their culture. That is literally in their culture.
You know, with the accountability factor, and you said, you talked about the multiple agencies there, how has that worked out? And, you know, from your understanding, if Highway Patrol comes in here, they answering to Gavin Newsom. Yep. Okay, that's how that works. So anything they do is on his purview. But if something happens to the people in the city of Oakland, we pay for it. Doesn't come out of Gavin Newsom's budget.
Not with CHP. They would sue the state.
Okay.
And however, though, because they have contracted, and this part I'm not as sure about. Maybe there's a lawyer that's listening that pays attention to this kind of stuff. This is what I have James Birch for. But because it happens in Oakland, I don't think we're completely off of the hook.
Okay. So where do things go now, and what should people be doing? I mean, talk to some of the people that are listening that's going, Kat, I hear you, but the streets are just crazy right now, and we need all the help. And if Northeastern is going to pay for that, we can save some money. It's a win-win for everybody, right? It's a win-win. It's not coming out of our budget. Let Northeastern patrol East Oakland and keep us safe, and then we can concentrate the quote-unquote shorthanded cops. They can go to other areas and protect us, and we don't have to worry. What do you say to that sort of rationale? Because that's what's being sold to us.
Yeah. I mean, I say what I said at the top, right? We have the CHP, we have Alameda County Sheriffs, we have BART Police, we have East Bay Parks and Rec, we have the Oakland Police Department, at least two other agencies that are rolling through our community at any given time. That's seven law enforcement agents. We know where the FBI is here. There's at least seven law enforcement agencies. ICE is rolling, DHS is rolling through our streets, right? Like, so again, what is the magic number of law enforcement agencies, cops, and dollars that is going to get us to safety? Or are we finally ready to admit that we cannot arrest our way out of poverty and the things that are born from it? That we cannot arrest our way out of racism and the things that are born from it? And that we actually have to invest in the very community that has been divested from and disrespected and disregarded and ignored and abused and traumatized? That we actually have to start addressing that, and that's how we get safe. And as a matter of fact, so the planning, whatever, the committee for the police department, police force at Northeastern, they decided all of this without talking to a single solitary resident in East Oakland. They didn't ask.
Oh, wow.
They did not ask the residents of East Oakland what they wanted with it. So it's $20 million. They got $20 million. First of all, we already know that that's going to last about 2 months for a police force. Let's be real, right? Second of all, East Oakland didn't ask for that. So on the back end, so of course people raise that issue, like, why are these people who don't even live in East Oakland deciding what happens to East? You know how our relatives in the East are? That's their community, right? And they're proud of it, and they take ownership of it. So we raised that question too. So what these folks did is they put out a survey to ask the people. You know what East Oakland says that they want?
What?
MacArthur fixed. They want it to stop being a transit hazard zone. They want children to stop being hit by cars. That's what East Oakland wants. So now my question to Northeastern is, so are you going to divert your funds to actually do what the community wants? You're going to keep on with your gentrifier colonizer plan to continue to terrorize our folks? East Oakland knows what it wants. It don't want more police. MacArthur, that strip of MacArthur right there is one of the most dangerous strips in the entire city of Oakland. It is a high hazard traffic zone. It will take $40 to $50 million to fix that. So if you really care about East Oakland and you really want East Oakland to be safe, Northeastern, then redirect the funds to that. The people have spoken. They've told you what they want.
Northeastern having a police force, did that leave open other entities to have a police force of their own? So if I want to attract business here, let's say we want to bring Apple, you know, to Oakland, or Uber, as they were supposed to come, do they get to go through the mechanisms and have their own police force, you know, that, you know, takes care of at least their property? You know, if I buy the old army base or something, or we have an apartment complex, do we get to have our own police force? How does that work?
Well, you know, people in this, the example I thought you were going to bring up, and I can't remember which community it was in the Hills, but remember, the people in the Hills had, at the beginning of this latest iteration of fear mongering, they did create, you know, their own police force, and violence ensued. And to be honest with you, Davey,
was it security or police? Yeah, actual police?
Security. It was private security.
Yeah, private security. I'm talking about
police force.
What Northeastern is able to do, or most of the universities.
Well, what I'm saying, it's not odd for a university to have their own police department, right? So we know UC Berkeley has a police department, and we know UC Berkeley terrorizes and brutalizes not only black folks, but unhoused folks, right? Like, they are off the hook over there in partnership with the BPD, which everybody thinks because it's Berkeley is all calm and mellow. No. No, they are a brutal, violent police state over there. So I wouldn't be surprised if they got their own. What is unusual is that then they get to write all of East Oakland. I think, like UCB, they're limited to like the immediate surrounding area, I think. One president ago, I would have said, you know, we're going to have the levers to fight back. That's not going to happen, you know, in Oakland. Like, that's going to cause too much of an uproar. This dude sitting in the White House, this cop violence loving president, I don't know what's going to happen in this landscape. I think that police departments, all of the things that we're already seeing, some of the gains that we've made be rolled back. The slashing of anything that actually keeps people safe. I mean, and comments like cops should have a day of impunity to go and do whatever they want. So yeah. I think we're going to see more law enforcement agencies of all the varieties, not less.
Something to definitely think about. Again, I come back to the privatization of police, and that's where I think this is headed. You know, people looking at laws, figuring out and be like, no, I just don't want a security guard. I want somebody who can detain and arrest you. I know that some places have hired off-duty cops, and I would imagine they have the right to arrest and do, you know, a little bit more rights than the security. But that's where I think it's headed. You know, it's like, hey, I got my, you know, I'm going to annex myself, at least in terms of who patrols our streets. And if Northeastern is successful at this, I think it's going to open up some floodgates. Or if it makes national attention and somebody like the current administration in the White House goes, let's co-sign this. We need more of this all over America. That may be the blueprint for them terrorizing, you know, democratic cities under the guise that they're not safe. Something to definitely think about. Or they may expand ICE and have them patrol. I just feel that these are things that are being spoken about, and sadly there are people that are cheering this sort of thing on that live within our city limits.
Yeah, I mean, even our folks, right? I mean, the conditions are so bad that the conditions are so bad, and then you've got the narrative, right? The fear-mongering, the incitement of terror that is happening from the top down. Those two things collide, and we get to a place, and by we, I'm talking about Black folks, we get to a place where we will sell anything, including our souls, for the illusion of safety. And I call it an illusion because, as Andrea Ritchie says, you know, we're on a rock spinning a bazillion miles a second inside of a universe that we don't even fully understand. How safe can you possibly be? Yeah. But it's also the illusion of safety, because all of the data says this is not the pathway to safety. And if it was, we have spent enough money and we have enough cops that Oakland should be one of the safest cities in the country.
Reminds me of Uvalde. Remember that?
Yes.
One of the most heavily patrolled areas in the country. I think they have like 14 police agencies, and none of them could stop one person.
Well, none of them went to try to stop one person. They cowered outside with the screaming community.
Yeah. So something to think about. Kat Brooks, thank you. Tell people how to get a hold of you and ATPT, and tell us anything that you want to give in terms of marching orders. Did I mess up the initials?
You did. I'm going to help you out, though. It's the Anti-Police Terror Project.
Okay.
It is APTP. It's my fault. It sounds like a virus. It does. Yeah. It's like I'm a communicator, and that's like the worst communications choice I ever made in my life. But, you know, it sounds hyphy when we get it right. You can find us at antipoliceterrorproject.org. We're on all of the socials. We're still even on that evil, evil place, Twitter. We're on Blue Sky, Facebook, you know. Marching orders, pay attention. Subscribe to our newsletter. Pay attention. We'll be sending out notices about this. We're going to be doing our own set of surveys for the community. We will be in conversation with Oakland City Council about this and any efforts for them to co-sign this trash. So there definitely will be calls to action. So just stay tuned.
Okay, there you have it. Kat Brooks, we appreciate you coming on. We're going to take a break on Hard Knock Radio. We'll be right back.
Hard Knock Radio. We're rocking with Picasso.
What?
And Maya.
Who?
My last name is Susana. Yeah, yeah.
I need a dollar, dollar, dollar. That's what I need. Hey, hey. Well, I need a dollar, dollar, dollar. That's what I need. Hey, hey.
Bienvenidos y bienvenidas. Welcome to PNA, Poor People's Revolutionary Radio. This is your co-host, Muteado Silencio, con Voces de Migrantes en Resistencia, with formerly houseless youth scholar Tiburcio Garcia and poverty scholar Popoy Mi Carnala Tiny.
Yeah, this is PNN, not CNN, people. That's Poor People's Revolutionary Radio. Plastic bags and foam cups hung from its metal teeth like poisonous saliva climbing up. Its steel claws scraped and screamed the asphalt rough. It'd been days since I slept, 'cause nothing was safe. But then I found this place, where you could throw yourself away. Only torn tarps and trashed car parts, and trashed me and my trashed heart. My eyelids hurt. If I could just sleep. And then I got the old jacket and the paper bag pillow placed just right as the torn up day became the torn up night. I heard the rumble, the growing thunder. I heard my own death approach. But where could I go? They already kicked me off every road. For James Edward Oakley, for Cornelius Taylor, for Shannon Marie Bigley, who should still be alive.
From Maya to Africa, from Haiti to Sagorate, the war on the poor isn't limited to the violence we houses people experience here in Occupy and stolen Turtle Island. It comes from a legacy of colonial dominance reaching from Maya to Africa. Today we begin the story of James Edward Oakley, who was run over by a bulldozer sweep of his house's body in Soca Vallejo, aka Occupy Zagorate, by the city gangsters hate, and then onto a report of our brothers and sisters from the continent of the violence in Goma in Congo, with our resident diaspora African reporter Jeremy Miller. And then we move on to the struggle of Haitian immigrants in the moment of so much colonial fascism. All of that and much more after this short music break.
That's for Brother James and for Mama D, all the old school R&B heads. I'm broken up myself right now, having a lot of trouble trying to put words together. The violence of this colonial war on the poor across Mama Earth, from Palestine to Turtle Island, from Zagorate to so-called Oakland. Our relatives are being openly murdered. And the way we look at it is these are just the relatives we know about. So we're blessed to have a couple of warriors, our beautiful sister Lori Herrera, our magazine family out in so-called Vallejo, a.k.a. Zagorate, and sibling Eli, who is one of the facilitators helping to make the Vallejo Homeless Union possible. We're going to start with listening to Brother Sean O'Malley, who's one of the leaders of the Vallejo Homeless Union, talking about Brother James with Lori.
We're here with the Vallejo Homeless Union and our brother Sean.
My friend James, I knew him for about 3-4 years. He's a friend of mine. He was a homeless man, and he lived down in an area by himself. He wasn't part of an encampment. But the city was doing a debris pickup one day, and they told him, they were trying to get him to move for a couple weeks before, so the city was fully aware that he was there. And so they moved him out of where he was at, and they hit him with a backhoe tractor. They rolled over him, killing him.
So again, that was Brother Sean O'Malley, one of the leaders of the Vallejo Homeless Union. I want to bring in Sister Lori and sibling Eli of the Homeless Union. Welcome, relatives. First of all, what's the Vallejo Homeless Union? How did it get started?
Feels like 100 years ago, but it hasn't even been a year. Around July, with the Grants Pass, Johnson case, we felt it was time to fight, and here we are today. And James Oakley, I mean, I think Sean described it very well. The city came in supposedly to do a debris removal. They knew he was there. They'd known he was there for weeks. We have three people that saw him talking to city workers 2 hours before the phone call. So he was alive. We don't know exactly what happened in those final moments.
You know, we walk with our ancestors every day in terms of the work that we do. Always walking with the spirit of Santa Marie Begley on the side of the I-80, run over by a bulldozer. Mm-hmm. Cornelius Taylor in so-called Atlanta, less than a month ago, run over by a bulldozer. The violence that's rolling through these occupied streets right now, these sweeps are killing us, literally, not even metaphorically. I wanted to bring in Sister Lori on this.
The Vallejo Homeless Union is a group of unhoused folks and formerly unhoused folks who have organized because they just can't take it anymore. We have nowhere left to go. Where do we go? If you don't want to create solutions for us, if you don't want to find answers for the most vulnerable people, don't get in our way. If you're not willing to help us survive, you have no right to interfere in how we survive. It's timely, it's necessary, and it is truly born out of the resistance of what folks are enduring every day outside and the support we're not getting. These folks are doing good work. this is the people.
I know there's a culture, if people don't know, that's a Klan town, right? There's a culture of hate, anti-blackness, anti-poor people. Eli.
Vallejo is a strange and surreal place. Its reputation speaks for itself. We are one of only five cities in California to ever have a police department investigated by the Department of Justice. We have officers on the force that have admitted in court in a civil case that they were part of a murder club, vending badges to celebrate their kills, that are still on the force, one of which who has definitely been promoted. You know, what can you say?
We love you, relatives. We'll talk to you really soon. Stay tuned after this short music break. We'll be right back with our African diasporic street reporter, Mr. Jeremy Miller. From Segorite to South Africa, our relatives are under attack on these violent colonial wars. Look here in this occupied land and connecting those dots from Haiti to the continent. No better person to do that powerful work than Poor Magazine poverty scholar in residence, cop watcher, Mr. Jeremy Miller. Welcome back to Poor People's Radio.
Glad to be with you.
Looking today with our relatives in Goma in the DR Congo. Give us some framing and some knowledge for that.
I would encourage anyone and everyone that hears my voice right now to engage in economic and cultural boycott as you are able of the nation state of Rwanda. I want to lead with that because often we get caught in the weeds of the histories and politics and whatnot, and we lose sight of the limited nodes of possibility, the limited action steps that we can take to do our little part to try and exert people power. What's happening in not just Goma, but the Kivus? Let's start there. The Kivus, that is to say North and South Kivu, are provinces in the east of the nation that is now known as the Democratic Republic of Congo, formerly known as Zaire. Goma is the capital of North Kivu province. There's another capital that was taken in recent days, Bukavu, which is the capital of South Kivu. Again, eastern region of the DRC, which borders Uganda, Rwanda, and Burundi. What has happened is since the end of January of this year, 2025, there has been an increase in military activity from a paramilitary group known as M23 in the Kivus. And they have sort of made a lightning takeover of major swaths of the Kivus. Goma, as has been mentioned, very important strategic locations. This is also the area where a lot of the mining operations occur for rare earth minerals such as tantalum, coltan. This is like the heartland of Congolese wealth. For those who seek to control the fruits of the earth, or for that matter, control the production chains for things that here in the quote-unquote first world we use all the time, like smartphones and laptops and such things, this is what you want to control. This is power. There are militias and governments and states fighting over who can control it. One of the primary reasons that this warfare is going on. There are also millions of people who live in the Kivus who are suffering through this. To unpack this, you have to go back at least to the Rwandan genocide in the 1990s, 1994. In 1994, there was massive killings in Rwanda. It's usually referred to as Hutu extremists committing genocide against Tutsis. That did happen. The truth is a bit more complicated. What is less well understood is that genocide occurred on both sides, Hutu on Tutsi and Tutsi on Hutu. And it did not end in 1994. In fact, after the Rwandan Patriotic Army, later Rwandan Patriotic Front, led by Paul Kagame, took power in Kigali, that's the capital of Rwanda. They pursued the Hutus across the border into the Democratic Republic of Congo, through the Kivus in particular, because, of course, this is the border region. And this led into the two Congo Wars, which lasted all the way through the end of the 90s. 6 million dead, absolute carnage. There were atrocities all around, many, many, many committed by Rwandan-backed forces. Coming back to today, Rwanda is a very, very small, landlocked country. Its economy is largely based on two things. One is aid money from the West. The United States is a major contributor, but not exclusively. And the other major input to Rwanda's economy, is selling minerals, coltan, tantalum, diamonds, etc. Selling all these minerals. The only problem is they don't have them. They don't come from there. There's a hustle going on here. Congo gets economically exploited, effectively raped of its resources, and then they get shuffled through Rwanda or Uganda to market where the Europeans and the Americans, etc., can get their grubby little hands on it. This has been going on for decades. It's estimated that since the Ukraine war broke out in 2022, there have been give or take 12,000 civilian deaths. Estimate. It is estimated that since the end of January in the Kivus, there have been over 8,000 civilian deaths. Last thought, guns do not grow in the ground. When this happened last time, which was 2012, the tap was cut off. Political support was cut off, armament support was cut off, and it went away. This implicates the United States, implicates Great Britain, it implicates China, and implicates France, etc. If people really want to see this carnage end, much like the calls for stopping arming Israel in the Palestine conflict, we have to stop the flow of the weapons. Stop arming the people that are committing the atrocity. That especially should make people in the United Capitalist Prison States of America look in the mirror.
Jeremy, thank you so much. And I really appreciate all of your scholarship. And we'll be talking to you really soon. Stay tuned after this short music break. We'll be back with IT and that genocide.
Please believe these flows teach egos to freeze and then reseed. I'm C4 beneath your Jeep. The second you turn that key hold and heat blows, your weak flows right out the water. The father, boy, I work smarter and harder. My style got a restraining order. Don't bother. I charter unseen territories in order to push it farther than you that ever thought. I caught a lot of murder charges, turn artists to martyrs.
Colonial terror happens all over Mama Earth in ways seen and unseen. And also poverty and colonial dominance and struggle to survive is everywhere, from Maya to Africa, from so-called Vallejo to Haiti. So we have the blessing of having a relative who is of Haitian descent, the son of Migrante folks from that part of Mama Earth. Welcome, Romain, to Poor People's Radio.
Thank you for having me.
We're in this time where the Cracker King is ascending on everybody. Your folks are still coming.
Due to a U.S.-backed paramilitary effort through violent gangs in Haiti, sabotaging pro-democracy, pro-workers movements in Haiti, there's been hundreds of thousands of people displaced from Haiti to other countries, namely the Dominican Republic, which is seeking to repress Haitians and deport Haitians en masse, and as well as Haitians who have settled along the U.S.-Mexico border, some of which are obviously settled on the Mexican side of that border. But of course, there are also Haitians who are making it through and have settled in cities in California. There's a lot of Haitian Americans in American history. Now we're seeing an even stronger push in Haitian immigration to the Americas.
Tell listeners a little bit about this notion of the quote-unquote gangs. They've criminalized the entire country with his use of the word gangs.
There are several gangs and gang leaders that have been employed by Haitian oligarchs and have been armed through illegal weapons smuggling from the United States to essentially empower them to kill pro-democracy activists in Haiti, particularly pro-democracy neighborhoods that become enclaves of building people power in Haiti. They have done swaths of massacres in the capital city, Port-au-Prince, crimes against humanity, all at the hands of the evil corporations, particularly in the garment industry, such as Walmart, Target, and Gap. There were a lot of protests happening before the assassination of the president and these gangs that caused this stability. Protests that were demanding livable wage, better living conditions for Haitians who were mostly making a dollar a day, and were seeing an increase in the price of gas and food, and was just becoming incredibly unlivable. And this is how imperialism operates. It doubles the exploitation onto the global south and tries to make them pick up the slack of whatever demands they don't want to meet for their workers in the mother nation, who may be going on strike or may be seeing a dip in production.
Romain, we are running out of time, but we'd love to have you come back. We need more truth tellers about all of our relatives across Mama Earth. Any last words you'd like to leave the listeners with today?
I believe that all people will be free, and it's going to take fighting imperialism wherever it may manifest. I especially want to celebrate the victories of the Gazan resistance and the smashing of colonialism everywhere, and especially in Palestine. And those chains will eventually be broken in Haiti, and my people will be free.
Thank you so much, Romain. We'll be talking to you soon or see you on the street before.
I need a dollar, 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 that's what I need. Hey, hey, well, I need a dollar, dollar, dollar.
Thank you so much for tuning in. As usual, this is your radio engineer, Tibu Garcia. That's all for this broadcast today. I just want to say thank you to everyone listening, but I also want to thank all of the guests that we had on the show. Thank you so much. All power to the people.
Talk, don't stop. EMN at it again. Sandman, Daddy Man, Chris, Juwan, Cam. Yeah. Innovation, stimulating ill conversation. Anything else, just imitation. Simulation, step into the zone. The Bay Area zone. Hard Knock Radio, let's go.
Big shout out to Need and Davy D. Yeah, right, feel me. Yeah. Honing down at Hard Knock Radio.
Hard Knock Radio.
Kinda crazy though. Oakland, stand up.
Yeah. Stand up.
Ensemble, Big Night Wolves.
Yeah. Kansas City.
Yeah. Yeah.
Bellevue.
Hard Knock, when they ain't going all in and ain't paid the cost or the fee. Hating that they made they beats, trying to eat till they're ready from the steel grave. Beats, say please. Maybe they'll save you a seat at the table with their great bread making a speech. Say some peace to their lovers, our neighbor to please. Hey, there's some shade on your name in the street. Let's go. It ain't David G.
Real Talk Radio.
You and I rocking with the best in the West.
Yes, Coast. Monday through Friday.
Sing it, Chris.
East Coast.
Bilal Sunni Ali joins the ancestors. When he was born on 13th July, 1948, his parents named him William R. Johnson, by father, Robert Lloyd Johnson, and mother, Lois Ethel Johnson. His name would later become Bilal Sunni Ali, and it would long reverberate in the worlds of black radical politics and music. Music moved him as a third grader, where he picked up the clarinet and later the tenor sax and the flute. Apparently, he had a thing for woodwinds. He started a band when he was 12 years old. His first band was named The Symphony. He and his bandmates said their group played music from heaven. This was the same age when he met a man who wrote detective stories. His name? Gil Scott Heron. Gil Scott Heron later found fame as a forerunner of rap, a wonderful poet, and a singer of considerable range and power. A few years later, Sunni Ali and other band members would form the Simba Drummers and Dancers, where they wore dashikis, or African-style garments for men. His fellow bandmates included Eddie Adinola Knowles and Cosmic Charlie Saunders. When Belial was 22, he joined the famous Midnight Band, which backed Gil Scott Heron. But he didn't just join bands. As a teenager, he met Lumumba Shakur and Zaid Malik Shakur, and also Sekou Odinga. These were the guys who helped found the Harlem and Bronx chapters of the Black Panther Party in New York. So Belial Sunni Ali wasn't just a talented musician, he was a revolutionary as well. In 1975, he went underground and reportedly worked for Black freedom and national independence in the Black Liberation Army. From his earliest to his latest years, he believed that music was a powerful tool of human healing. Sheikh Baba Belial Kume Ben Sunni Ali passed his last breath on December 30th, 2024, surrounded by his many children, his numerous grandchildren, his ex-wives and his wives. He was surrounded by an ocean of love. Now he plays music with the ancestors, with love, not fear. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Prison Radio.
Out of track,
subject to
oh, oh, oh. You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
You're listening to KBOO's All Thrills, No Frills, Volume 4 special programming campaign. Check out all the great programs we're